This is Audible.
Gigantic Productions, in association with Empty Set Entertainment, presents Nocturnal, a novel, by Scott Sigler. Performed by Phil Giganti. For Bird Level, who makes things happen. For Julian Pavia, and the amazing job he did helping me make this novel what it is. And for A. Kovacs, who keeps me sane. Book 1. People. Chapter 1. Penance. You're not welcome here, Paul. Most places in the world, a statement like that sounded normal. Unfriendly, perhaps, but still common, still acceptable. Most places, but not at a Catholic church. But someone's following me, Paul said. And it's cold out. Paul's eyes flicked left, flicked right, too fast to take anything in. He looked haunted. That wasn't Father Esteban Rodriguez's problem. This man, if he could be called that, would never again be allowed in the Cathedral of St. Mary of the Assumption. Never again. You've been told, Esteban said. You're not part of this church anymore. Paul's eyes narrowed, cleared. For a moment, Esteban saw a glimmer of the wit that had made Paul so popular, so engaging. What about forgiveness? Paul said. That's what we're all about, forgiveness of our sins. Or are you better than our Savior? Esteban felt rage, a rare emotion, and quickly fought to bring it under control. I am only a man, he said. Perhaps a weak one at that. Maybe the Lord can forgive you your sins, but I can't. You may not seek shelter here. Paul looked down. He shivered. Esteban shivered too. San Francisco's evening chill, a wet, clinging thing, rolled through the church door that Esteban blocked with his body. Paul wore a sagging blue coat that had once probably been puffy and shiny. Maybe it had looked nice on the original owner, whomever that might be, however many years ago that was. Paul's pants were dirty, not caked with filth, but spotted here and there with finger streaks of food, grease, other things. Years ago, this man had helped care for the homeless. Now he looked like one of them. I have nowhere to go, Paul said to the ground. That is not the church's problem. That is not my problem. I'm a human being, Father. Esteban shook his head. This disgusting, demonic creature before him thought himself human. You don't belong here. You're not wanted here. This is a sanctuary. One doesn't let wolves in among the sheep. Why don't you go somewhere you do belong? If you don't leave, I'll call the police. Paul looked away, down the street. He seemed to be searching for something. Something specific. Something that wasn't there. I told the police, Paul said. Told them someone was following me. What did they say? Paul looked Esteban in the eyes. Pretty much the same thing you did, Father. Whatever a man sows, this he will also reap, Esteban said. Hell has a special place for people like you. Leave. Now. Sadness filled Paul's eyes. Desperation. Despair. Perhaps the final understanding that this part of his life was over. Paul looked beyond Esteban, through the door to the church interior. The look of sadness changed to one of longing. Paul had spent many years in this very building. Those days were gone forever. Paul turned and walked down the church's wide steps. Esteban watched him reach the sidewalk of Gough Street, then cross and continue down O'Farrell. Esteban shut the door. Paul Maloney hunched his shoulders high, tried to burrow his ears into his coat. He needed a hat. So cold out at night. Wind drove the fog, a fog thick enough that you could see wisps of it at eye level. He walked down O'Farrell Street, home to strip clubs, drug dealers and whores, an asphalt swath of sin and degradation. Part of him knew he belonged here. Another part, an older part, wanted to scream and yell, tell all these sinners where they would go unless they took Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior. The gall of Father Esteban. Hell has a special place. Maybe for Esteban. Maybe for men like him who purported to preach the word when they didn't even understand it. God loved Paul Maloney. God loved everyone. Someday, Paul would stand by his side. It would be Esteban who would feel the fires. Esteban, and the others who had kicked Paul out of the only life he'd ever known. Paul turned left on Jones Street. Where would he go? He had a constant churning need for human contact that continued to surprise him. Not the type of contact that had changed his life, just the normal act of a kind word, a conversation, a connection. He'd spent so many years in the church, so many years in front of a steady stream of people. Even during the long periods of study, of contemplation, his isolation was self-imposed. People were always a few rooms away. There was always someone out there to talk to if he so chose. But for the past couple of years, no one had wanted to talk to Paul Maloney. He had to be careful everywhere he went. Some of the sinners around here would pass judgment with their fists and feet. 2 in the morning. People were still on the street, especially in this part of town, but not many. No kids out at this hour. A shame. Behind him, a noise. The sound of metal scraping lightly against brick. Paul whirled. No one there. His heart hammered. He'd turned, thinking he would see the man with the shaggy black beard and the green John Deere ball cap. How many times had Paul seen that man in the past week? 4? Maybe 5? Please, Heavenly Father, don't let that man be a parent. The sound came again. Paul turned so fast he stumbled. What had made that scraping noise? A pipe? Maybe some bag lady pushing a cart with a broken wheel? He looked for the bearded man, but the bearded man wasn't there. Paul put his cold hands on his face. He rubbed hard, trying to shake away the fear. How had it come to this? He hadn't done anything wrong. Not really. He just loved so much. And now this was his life. 1 foot in front of the other, walking through loneliness, until he died. I must be strong, he said. I will fear no evil because you are with me. By... A whisper of air behind him, the sound of something heavy falling, the slap of shoe soles against damp concrete. Paul started to turn, but before he could see what it was, strong hands locked onto his shoulders. Chapter 2. Good morning, sunshine. As the sun rose, the shadows crawled along the streets of San Francisco, shrinking away into the buildings that spawned them. Brian sat on the ledge of his apartment building's roof, watching the dawn. Bathrobe, boxers, a cup of coffee, feet dangling 6 stories above the sidewalk below. A little slice of the good life. He loved his daily rooftop ritual, but normally his work ended with the rising sun. At dawn, Brian Clouser usually went to sleep. He rarely had to work the day shift, a perk of both his seniority and the fact that few other people wanted to pursue murder investigations from 8 at night until 4 in the morning. His beloved night shift would have to wait, however. The Oblomowitz case had stagnated, and Chief Amy Zhao had to show some kind of movement, or the press would eat her alive. When a local loaded businessman is found floating in 3 separate barrels in the San Francisco Bay, the media wants answers. Zhao would masterfully ration pieces of information, steadily feeding the media hounds what they wanted to hear, until those hounds gradually lost interest and moved on to the next story. Zhao had a press conference playbook so predictable that the cops she commanded had labeled the steps. Step 1, gather information, but don't make assumptions. Then step 2, put our senior people on the case. She had already moved past step 3, creation of a multidisciplinary task force, and sailed headlong into the media-pleasing step 4, assign additional resources. In this instance, additional resources meant pulling in the night shift guys. Zhao gave orders to Jesse Sherrow, the homicide department captain, and Sherrow gave orders to Brian. So, day shift it was. Brian scratched at his short, dark red beard, and his hands came away wet. Sometimes he forgot to dry that off. It was getting a little long. Not too bad yet, but he'd have to trim it in a day or two, or his look would slide from casually cool to newly homeless. He pulled his black terry cloth robe a little tighter. Chilly up here. He sipped his coffee and looked north to his view of San Francisco Bay. Not much of a view, really. A postage stamp-sized space at the far end of Laguna that showed a strip of blue water, then the dark mass of Angel Island, and beyond that the faraway, starry light twinkling of sleepy Tiburon. He couldn't even see the iconic Golden Gate Bridge from here. Too many taller buildings in the way. Views were for the rich. Cops don't get rich. Not the clean ones, anyway. People called his job homicide inspector, but that wasn't how it felt to Brian. He didn't inspect. He hunted. He hunted murderers. It was his life, his reason for being. Whatever might be missing from his world, those things faded away when the hunt began. As corny as it sounded, this city was his home, and he was one of its protectors. He'd been born here, but his dad had moved around during Brian's childhood and teenage years. Indianapolis for grade school, Atlanta and junior high, Detroit for his freshman and sophomore years. Brian had never really felt at home anywhere, not until they moved back to the city for his junior year in high school. George Washington High. Good times. From his robe pocket, his cell phone sounded the tone of an incoming two-way message. He didn't have to check who it was, because only his partner used that feature. Brian raised the phone to his ear and thumbed the two-way button. I'm ready.
No, you're not. You're probably up on your roof drinking coffee.
No, I'm not. Brian said, then took a sip.
You probably aren't even dressed.
Yes, I am.
You're an LLWTL.
Pookie and his made-up acronyms. What the hell is an LLWTL?
A lying liar who tells lies. It puts on the clothes or it gets the horn again.
Brian drained the coffee mug and set it on the ledge to his left. Three other mugs were already sitting there. He made a mental note to grab them the following night. He usually didn't bother with the orphaned mugs until there were five or six sitting there like a little ceramic calendar marking the last time he'd bothered to clean up after himself. He hurried to the fire escape and started down to his apartment. If he wasn't down on the street by the time Pookie's Buick rolled up, the man would lean on the horn until Brian came out. Brian's neighbors just loved Pookie Chang. The damp metal steps felt cold on Brian's bare feet. Two flights down, he reached the narrow landing just outside his kitchen window and climbed inside. His kitchen was so small you couldn't fit two people in there and open the fridge at the same time. Not that he ever had two people in the kitchen. 6 months he'd lived in the one bedroom, and he still hadn't unpacked most of his boxes. Brian dressed quickly. Black socks, black pants, and a black T-shirt. His black Bianchi tuxedo holster came next, followed by a nylon forearm knife sheath. He scooped up his weapons from his coffee table. Tomahawk tactical fighting knife for the forearm sheath. SOG Twitch XL folding knife, clipped inside the pants to the left of the crotch. Hidden from sight, but within easy reach. Sig Sauer P226 in the holster. The SFPD issued the .40 caliber version to the entire force. It wouldn't have been his first choice for a main weapon, but that's what they gave you, and that's what you carried. The shoulder holster was equipped with two additional magazine pouches and a small handcuff holster. Brian dutifully filled these as well. Where a lot of cops carried a backup piece in an ankle holster, Brian wanted the full effect of an onion field gun, a gun that might be missed by perps should he be taken hostage. His was a tiny Seacamp LWS-32, a 32 caliber pistol so small it fit in an imitation wallet and slid into his back left pants pocket. He'd actually been a hostage once, been at the mercy of a perp who'd missed several days of meds. Brian never wanted to experience anything like that ever again. He shrugged on a black hoodie and zipped it up, hiding his holster from sight. As he slid past still-packed moving boxes and out his apartment door, he heard the faint, steady sound of a car horn. What an asshole. Brian skipped every other stair as he shot down four flights to the old-school lobby, sneakers slapping against chipped marble floors. Right out front was Pookie's shit-brown Buick, double-parked, completely blocking a lane. Passing cars honked, but if Pookie could hear them over his own car's horn, he didn't pay any attention. After 6 years together as partners, Brian knew Pookie's attitude all too well. Pookie was a cop. What was someone going to do, give him a ticket? Brian shot out the door onto the sidewalk and around the Buick. As usual, a stack of beat-up manila folders filled the passenger seat. Pookie Chang did not believe in technology. Brian scooped up the teetering mass, held it in his lap as he sat and shut the door. "Hey, Pooks." Brian reached across and patted Pookie's belly. "Did the Buddha like his donuts this morning?"
"We can't all have the metabolism of a hummingbird,"
Pookie said as he pulled into traffic on Vallejo Street.
"The choo-choo don't run without some coal in the engine. And Buddha? I could have internal affairs bring you up on racial intimidation charges for that. How would you like it if I called you a potato-eating McBastard?"
"Klauser is a German name, genius." Pookie laughed.
"Yeah, all those members of the master race have red hair and green eyes, just like you."
Brian shrugged. "Dark red. Irish have bright red. I'm German through and through, going back 3 generations. Besides, oh sensitive one, I was talking about your big Buddha belly, not your slanty eyes."
"Slanty eyes? Oh yeah, that's so much more politically correct. And I'm not fat, I'm big-boned."
"I remember when you bought that coat," Brian said. 4 years ago. You could button it then. Can you button it now?"
Pookie turned south on Van Ness, then cut across 2 lanes of traffic for no apparent reason. Brian automatically pressed his feet to the floor and grabbed the door handle. He heard honks and a few screeches as drivers quickly hit their brakes.
"We Chicagoans like to eat. You have your tofu and bean sprouts, Cali boy. I'll keep my brats and bear claws. Besides, the ladies love my belly. That's why in our cop show, you're the brooding, misunderstood, tough guy rebel. I'm the pretty one that gets the babes. In the grander hot or not scale, I'm ranked like 900 levels above you."
"That's a lot of levels."
Pookie nodded.
"Most assuredly."
"How's the script coming?"
Pookie's latest hobby was writing something called a series Bible for a police show. He had never acted a day in his life, never been involved in show business, but that didn't slow him down in the least. He attacked everything in life the same way he attacked a buffet. Pookie shrugged.
So-so. I thought a cop drama would write itself. Turns out not so much. But don't worry. I licked it like I licked your mom."
"Name the show yet?"
"Yeah, listen to this. Midnight Shield. How's that sit in your mouth?"
"Like bad sushi," Brian said. "Midnight Shield? Really?"
"Yeah, 'cause the characters are cops like us, and they work the overnight shift, and..."
"I get the wordplay, Pooks. It's not that I don't understand it, it just sucks."
"The fuck you know about entertainment?"
Pookie swerved sharply to cut off a Prius. He probably did that on purpose. He wasn't a fan of green energy, green technology, or anything else green that didn't come complete with the face of a dead president.
"Pooks, anyone ever tell you that you drive like shit?"
"I may have heard that once or twice, Bri-Bri, although I stand by my theory that feces can neither apply for nor pass a driver's license exam."
He accelerated through a yellow turning red.
"Don't worry. God loves me."
"Your imaginary sky daddy is going to keep you safe."
"Of course,"
Pookie said.
"I'm one of the chosen ones. If we get into an accident, though, I can't say what it'll do for you. You atheists are a bit lower on the miracle depth chart."
Pookie unexpectedly slowed and got into the left turn lane at O'Farrell. They were supposed to start the day at 850 Bryant, police headquarters. For that, they'd stay on Van Ness for another 4 blocks.
"Where are we going?"
"Someone found a body this morning,"
Pookie said.
537 Jones Street, kind of a big deal. Remember the name Paul Maloney?
It rings a bell, but I can't place it.
How about Father Paul Maloney?
No shit, the child molester.
Pookie nodded.
Child molester is too nice a word for the guy. Was too nice a word, I mean. He was murdered last night. Call him what he was, a rapist.
San Francisco hadn't escaped the wave of accusations that had crashed into the Catholic Church. Maloney first came to attention because he helped cover up early accusations against other priests who were clearly guilty. As more and more adults came forward about what had happened to them as children, the reasons for Maloney's efforts became clear. He wasn't just protecting pedophiles. He was one himself. Investigations ensued, producing enough clear-cut evidence that Maloney was finally defrocked. It didn't surprise Brian that someone had killed the man. That didn't make it right, not by any stretch, but it wasn't exactly a shocker.
Wait a minute, Brian said. Time of death?
Where it is about 3 or 4 a.m.
So why didn't we get called in?
That's what I'd like to know,
Pookie said.
We're temporarily assigned to days and all, but the Maloney murder is just as high profile as Oblomowitz. The press is going to circle jerk all over this one.
Circle jerk might not be the best metaphor, considering.
Sorry, Mr. Sensitive, Pookie said. I'll refrain from sexual innuendo.
Who got the case?
Verdi.
Brian nodded. No wonder Pookie wanted to get to the scene.
Polyester Rich. Nice. Your favorite guy.
I love him so.
So we're driving to the crime scene to which we're not assigned to be a pain in Verdi's ass.
You're very deductive, Pookie said. They should make you a cop or something.
A murder scene, in daylight. That might bring about an uncomfortable situation Brian desperately wanted to avoid.
Any word on who the Emmy is for this?
Don't know,
Pookie said.
But you can't avoid the girl forever, Brian. She's a medical examiner. You're a homicide cop. Those things go together like chocolate and peanut butter. It's just been dumb luck she hasn't been at one of our scenes in the past 6 months. Maybe we'll luck out and Robin Bo Bobbin's pretty little face will be perched over the dead body.
Brian shook his head before he realized he was doing it.
I wouldn't call that lucky.
You really should give her a call.
And you really should mind your own business.
He didn't want to think about Robin Hudson. Time to change the subject.
Verdi's still working with Bobby Pigeon.
Verdi and the Birdman. Sadly, that would be a pretty kick-ass name for a cop show. But Verdi is just plain ugly, and they don't make primetime dramas about stoner cops.
Pookie turned left on Jones. This part of the city was a mix of buildings, two stories up to 5 or 6, most built in the 1930s or 1940s, and with the city's trademark angled bay windows. Just half a block away, 3 black and whites blocked the area. Pookie reached his hand out the window to place the portable bubble light on top of the Buick, then pulled a little closer and double parked.
This case should be ours, he said as he got out. Especially if this is some vigilante bullshit.
I know, Brian said. Rule of law and all that.
537 Jones Street was a 2-story building sandwiched between a parking garage and a 5-story apartment complex. Half of 537 was a locksmith, the other half a mail services building. Brian saw little movement inside the buildings. Up above, however, he saw bits of motion. Pookie pointed up.
The goddamn roof?
Brian nodded.
Curiouser and curiouser.
A whiff of something strange tickled Brian's nose. There, then gone. They ducked under police tape. The uniform smiled at Pookie, nodded at Brian. Pookie waved to each, calling them by name. Brian knew their faces, but most times, names were beyond him. They entered the building, found the stairs, and headed up. Pookie and Brian stepped onto a flat roof painted in many gloopy layers of light gray. A morning breeze hit them from behind, snapping their clothes just a little. Rich Verdi and Bobby Birdman Pigeon stood near the body. Fortunately, the Emmy was not a hot little Asian woman with her long black hair done up in a tight bun. It was a silver-haired man who moved with the stiff slowness of age. He was squatting on his heels, examining some detail of the deceased. Light-colored roofs aren't a good complement to splattered blood. Long brown lines and streaks marked the rough gray paint, creating a Jackson Pollock canvas of death and dirt. The body lay twisted in a rather unnatural position. The deceased's legs looked broken, both forelegs and femurs.
Wow,
Brian said.
Someone had it in for that guy.
Pookie put on his aviator sunglasses, then feathered back his heavy black hair. He'd started doing that since he began the series Bible. Hollywood wasn't calling yet, but Pookie Chang would be ready when it did.
Had it in for a child rapist? Gee, Bri, I can't imagine a connection like that. What's under the top, I wonder?
Pookie pointed to the right of the body. A blue, police-issue tarp flapped in the light morning breeze, its corners held down by duct tape. The tarp lay flat against the roof, no room for body-sized lumps, or even severed limb-sized lumps beneath it. Some of the streaks of dried brown blood led under the blue material. The wind caught an edge of the tarp,
just a little, lifting it. Like the flash of a fan dancer, Brian saw a here-then-gone glimpse of what was underneath. Was that a drawing of some kind?
"Hey,"
Pookie said.
"Dear me, is that old man Metz?"
Brian nodded as soon as Pookie said the name.
"Yeah, that's the Silver Eagle, all right. I haven't seen him outside the ME's office in, like, 5 years or so."
"That pisses me off," Pookie said. "I mean, even more than before. Did you know Metz was a consultant on that Dirty Harry reboot? Metz knows Hollywood types, and Verdi gets to work with him? Verdi is a pig fucker."
Metz wore a blue uniform jacket, gold braid around the cuffs, two rows of polished brass buttons down the chest. Most of the people from the medical examiner's office wore windbreaker jackets for pickups, but not Metz. He still sported the same formal attire that had been de rigueur for his department back in the day. Metz had been the main guy in the ME's office for 30 years. He was a law enforcement legend. When he walked into a courtroom, lawyers from both sides trembled. Under examination, he often made lawyers look like idiots. He'd written textbooks. He'd been consulted by some of the world's top crime writers. What Metz didn't do anymore, though, was go out into the field. The guy was pushing 70. Even the great ones have limits.
"I'm pissed. You ever see Metz in a courtroom? He's so effing cool. And he's the only one with a better nickname than you."
Some people in the department called Brian the Terminator.
"I'm half of Schwarzenegger's size, and I don't look anything like him."
"It's not about the looks, dummy. It's because you kill people,"
Pookie said.
"That and you have all the emotional response of a used Duracell. Don't be so sensitive. People only say it because they respect you."
Pookie would think that. He saw the world through rose-colored glasses. Pookie didn't seem to hear the condescending tone with which people used the nickname. Some guys in the department thought Brian was trigger-happy, a cop who used the gun as a default action instead of as a last resort.
"I'd rather you didn't use that name, okay?"
Pookie shrugged.
"Well, work as long as Metz and get that fabuloso gray do, and maybe they'll call you the Silver Eagle instead of him. I mean, look at that hair. Home Slice looks like a walking shampoo commercial."
Metz looked up from the body. He stared at Brian and Pookie for a second, gave a single nod, chin down, pause, chin up, then went back to work.
"He's so cool," Pookie said. "I'd like to be as cool as that when I'm his age, but I think I'll be busy filling my pants and drooling on myself."
"Everyone has to have goals, Pooks."
"True. Oh, that reminds me, later I'll tell you about my stock tip. Depends adult undergarments. An aging boomer population makes that stock gold. Brown gold, Brian."
"Not now," Brian said. "What the hell is that under the tarp?"
Rich Verdi looked up from the body and locked eyes with Brian and Pookie. He shook his head. It didn't take advanced skills to read his lips. These fucking guys. Pookie waved, high and happy.
"Morning, Rich! Hell of a day, ain't it?"
Rich walked over. Birdman followed, already shaking his head slowly and rolling his eyes. An odder couple you could not find. Rich Verdi was pushing 60. He'd been busting ass back when Brian and Pookie were in diapers. Verdi still dressed in the cheap polyester suits that had been in style when he'd made his bones 30 years earlier. His pencil mustache just screamed douchebag. Birdman had been promoted from Vice just a few weeks earlier. With his scraggly brown beard, brown knit hat, jeans, and tan Carhartt jacket, he looked more like someone who would be the arrestee than the arrestor. Verdi walked right up to Pookie until they almost touched noses.
"Chang," Verdi said. "What the fuck are you two cocksuckers doing here?"
Pookie smiled, reached into his pocket, pulled out a small plastic case and gave it an audible rattle.
"Tic-tac?"
Verdi's eyes narrowed. Pookie leaned to the left, gave an upward nod to Bobby.
"Hey there, Birdman!"
"Sup?"
Birdman said. He smiled. The morning sun glinted off his gold front left incisor.
"Bobby, don't talk to this asshole," Verdi said. "Clauser, Chang, get your asses the fuck out of here!"
Pookie laughed.
"You kiss your mother with that mouth?"
"No, but I kissed yours," Verdi said. "With tongue. Far as you know, I'm your daddy."
"If so, I thank God that chronic halitosis isn't congenital."
Pookie leaned to the right,
looked over Verdi's right shoulder.
I see the Silver Eagle came out for this one. That's good, Rich. That means everything will be ship-shape when Brian and I take over.
Verdi pointed to the roof door.
Get lost!
The wind reversed direction, bringing with it that smell. Urine. Urine and something else.
Jeez, Pookie said. Speaking of the pins, did someone forget theirs today?
Birdman nodded.
The purr pissed on him, man. Pretty messed up, huh?
Verdi turned.
Shut the fuck up, Bobby!
Bobby held up his hands, palms out. He walked back to Metz and Paul Maloney's body.
Hey,
Brian said.
You guys smell that? Not the piss. That other smell.
Pookie and Verdi both sniffed, thought about it, then shook their heads. How could they not smell that? Pookie offered Verdi the Tic Tacs again. Verdi just glared. Pookie shrugged and put them away.
Look, polyester, do me a favor and be thorough with your report, okay? Once the chief sees the Vic's name, you know she's going to give the case to us. We'd hate to have to call you to fill in the blanks.
Verdi smiled, shook his head.
Not this time, Chang. Zhao put us on this case herself. I wouldn't rock the boat on this one if I was you.
Pookie's ever-present, condescending grin faded a bit. He was eyeing Verdi up, seeing if the man was telling the truth. The roof suddenly shifted. Brian stumbled left, trying to keep his balance. Pookie caught him, steadied him.
Bri-Bri, you okay?
Brian blinked, rubbed his eyes.
Yeah, just got dizzy for a second.
Verdi sneered.
Take some advice, Terminator. Save the bottle for off-duty time.
Verdi turned and walked back to the body. Brian stared after the man.
I hate that name.
It's only funny when I use it, Pookie said. Bri-Bri, I want to go on record that I am officially unhappy with this staffing decision.
Zhao's call,
Brian said.
You know that means we have to accept it.
Pookie, of course, knew no such thing. He'd be angling for the case nonstop, no matter how exhausting that became to Brian.
Come on,
Brian said.
We have to get to the hall.
Pookie adjusted his sunglasses and refeathered his hair.
Fine by me, Bri-Bri. Can't really tell which one of them stinks like piss anyway.
Brian went down the steps first, that smell still tickling his nose. He was careful to keep a hand on the rail. Chapter 3. The Morning News. The buzz of an alarm clock brought Rex Dobrovtchuk awake. He'd been dreaming a great dream that made him feel wonderful inside. He tried to capture it, to lock in the memory, but it slipped away. The nice feeling faded, replaced by the aches of his body and that pain in his chest. Rex felt so sick. He just wanted to sleep. Wanting to sleep during the day was nothing new. He routinely dozed off during second-hour trig class. But this was different. He'd been hurting for days. His mother wouldn't let him stay home. He dragged himself out of bed. He blew his nose on some crusty Kleenex he'd used the night before, then shuffled out of his tiny bedroom into the hall. The hallway ran the length of the floor, a blank wall on the left, five doors on the right. The wall held old framed pictures from a time Rex barely remembered. Pictures of his dad, of Rex when he'd been really little, even pictures of his mom, smiling. He was glad for those pictures, because he had never seen her smile in person. Rex walked into the toilet room. The room was barely wider than the toilet tank itself. It wasn't really a bathroom, because it just had the toilet and a sink. The next room down had the bath, and no toilet, so Rex called that the shower room. He took care of his morning business and was headed back to his bedroom when he heard it. From down the hall, a voice on the TV made him stop. Not the voice itself, but the name the voice had spoken. A name both from Rex's unremembered dream and from his unforgettable past. He wiped his hand across his runny nose. He turned around and walked down the hall, past the shower room to the living room, which was just inside the front door. He entered quietly. His mother, Roberta, was sitting in her chair that faced the television. The screen's glow shone through her wiry hair.
silhouetting her skull. Rick stood there, waiting to hear the name again, because he'd just dreamed about that name, dreamed about that man. And he'd drawn a picture of that man just last night, before he went to bed. He had to have heard it wrong. But he hadn't.
Maloney was a longtime priest at the Cathedral of St. Mary of the Assumption in San Francisco, until he was caught up in a sex abuse scandal and removed from that post. Maloney served a year in jail and was on probation. San Francisco Chief of Police Amy Zhao said in a press conference this morning that the force is working to gather information on Maloney's murder, but that it's too early to make assumptions about the killer's motives.
Father Maloney's dead? Rick said the words without thinking. Had he thought, he would have quietly walked away. She turned, leaning over an armrest to look back at him. The television's light played off her pockmarked face. A cigarette dangled from her skinny fingers.
What are you doing in the TV room? I heard Father Maloney's name.
She squinted. She did that when she was thinking. She nodded almost imperceptibly.
I remember the lies you told about him, she said. Dirty, filthy lies.
Rex stood there, motionless, wondering if she'd get the belt.
Finish getting ready for school, she said. You hear me talking to you?
Yes, Roberta. She didn't like it if he called her Mom or Mother. When he'd been little, he'd called her those names, but sometime after his dad died, she told him to stop using them. Rex quickly walked out of the TV room before she could change her mind. Once out of her sight, he ran down the narrow hall to his bedroom. His room had a bed, a little TV with a video game console, a dresser, and a small desk with a stool, the sum total of his existence. He threw on his clothes and grabbed his backpack, remembering to get his notes for freshman English off the floor as he did. No time for a shower. He had to get out of the house before Roberta thought of a reason to get mad at him. He hoped he didn't smell like pee. Some bum was using the alley outside Rex's window as a bathroom. Not that it really mattered. Sometimes Roberta wouldn't let him shower at all. Before Rex left, he picked up the drawing sitting on his desk, the one he'd made last night. The picture showed a much larger Rex, a Rex with muscle-bound arms and a big chest, using his bare hands to snap Father Paul Maloney's left leg. Now Father Maloney was dead. The drawing made Rex feel funny. Funny and wrong. Rex put the drawing in the desk's drawer. He closed it, then looked at it to make sure no part of the drawing stuck out. Time for the long walk to school. Rex prayed he could avoid the Boyko bullies. Father Paul Maloney was dead, and that was awesome. Maybe for once, Rex could make it to school and back without getting his ass kicked. And the day would just keep getting better.
Chapter 4. All in the Family.
The San Francisco Hall of Justice takes up two full city blocks. The long, featureless, seven-story gray building located at 850 Bryant Street houses most divisions of the San Francisco Police Department. Gang Task Force, Homicide, Narcotic Vice, Fraud, Operations, and of course, Administration. SWAT and missing persons have offices elsewhere in the city, but by and large, most cop-related things that don't involve a local precinct happen at the hall. Brian set his weapons and keys on the conveyor belt, then walked through the metal detector. He recognized the old uniform on the other side. Recognized the face, anyway. Brian was shit with names.
Clouser?
The white hair said with a nod. Brian nodded back, then collected his gear. Pookie came through next.
Chang,
the cop said.
Lawrence, how's that artificial hip treating you?
They think the screws on the ball part are coming loose,
the man said.
Feels like someone is scraping a knife in my hip every time I take a step.
Terrible,
Pookie said, shaking his head in sympathy.
You suing?
Nah,
Lawrence said.
I just want it fixed.
Pookie gave the man's shoulder a squeeze.
Good man. You change your mind, holler at your boy. I know some great lawyers. Oh, and happy anniversary. Tell Margaret I said congrats on number... Is it 23?
Lawrence's hard face split in a smile, which lasted only a few seconds until he turned to glare the next person through.
Brian and Pookie headed for the elevators.
We gotta get you on Jeopardy, Brian said. How the hell do you remember this crap?
Pookie pushed the up button, then shrugged.
Not all of us are as antisocial as you, my black-clad little buddy.
Teddy Oblomowitz had been one of the city's financial golden boys, a heavy contributor to the San Francisco Opera, the ballet, GLBT charities, and just about anything involving a park. Oblomowitz had been a well-known philanthropist, a mover and a shaker. He had also been a money launderer. His murder, and the simultaneous disappearance of his wife, created reverberations throughout the organized crime community. Brian and Pookie walked into the conference room for the morning status meeting. Their fellow task force members were already there. Because money laundering was a financial crime, the task force included Christopher Kearney from the Economic Crimes Unit. Kearney was okay, except for the fact that he dressed in sweater vests like some Ivy League grad, and he insisted on being called Christopher. So, of course, everyone called him Chris. A case of this magnitude also necessitated participation from the district attorney's office, hence the presence of Assistant D.A. Jennifer Wills. No charges had been filed as of yet. The task force didn't even have a suspect. So Wills was just there to keep tabs on the case. She mostly stayed quiet, only piping up if a planned action might get a perp off the hook somewhere down the road. Since it was a murder investigation, homicide took lead. Inspectors Stephen Koning and Steve Ball Puller Boyd, also known as the Brother Steve, ran the fieldwork. Koning was as cool got, a stand-up guy by all accounts. Ball Puller Boyd, on the other hand, seemed to be oblivious to the fact that he was quite repulsive. The sweaty, porn-stashed, self-touching man had little concept of personal space. Assistant Chief Sean Robertson ran the show. He was second in command for the entire SFPD. Brian liked him. Robertson made people walk a fine line, but he was fair and didn't let the power go to his head. Everyone knew Robertson was being groomed as the future chief. Zhao was in her late 50s. Another 6 years, maybe, and the whole department would probably be Robertson's. Brian had seen all these faces before. Today, however, he noted a new one. A guy in a three-piece talking to Robertson. Brian nudged Pookie.
Pooks, check out the suit. Fed?
Pookie looked, nodded.
Yeah, but no way he's a gunslinger. Guy looks like he fights tax code. Excuse me for a moment, Bri-Bri. Daddy has to see about getting himself a date.
Pookie put on his best smile and closed in on Wills, the room's lone female. She was taking advantage of the pre-meeting lull to go over a legal pad full of notes.
Jen, Pookie said. Stylish, yes, always. That outfit new.
She didn't bother looking up.
I'm not your type, Chang, but good eye, it's new.
Of course it is. I could never forget seeing something that fetching. The shoes really set it off, and what do you mean you're not my type?
Jennifer looked up, brushed her blonde hair out of her face, then held up her left hand and wiggled her fingers.
No ring. Word on the streets is you only like the married ladies.
Pookie leaned back, put a hand on his chest.
Assistant D.A. Wills, I am hurt and offended by your insinuation that I contribute to infidelity.
She again bent to her legal pad. Pookie walked back to Brian.
Smooth,
Brian said.
Sexual tension, Pookie said. Vital to any good cop drama.
He tapped his forehead.
It all goes in the vault to someday be played out in my brilliant scripts.
Steve Boyd walked up to Brian and Pookie. He had a cup of coffee in his left hand. His right hand scratched at his balls. Where Polyester Rich's upper lip scraggled looked like it belonged on the face of a 1950s movie villain. Boyd's walrus mustache was so thick you could barely see his mouth move when he talked.
Closer, Chang,
Boyd said. The man tilted his head toward the suit.
Word is the nerd brought us a lead on the hitter.
Pookie sighed.
The hitter?
Ball Puller, you've been watching the AMC Gangster Movie Marathon again.
Never miss it, he said. I hope he's got something. We've been shaking down all of Abramowitz's clients, haven't come up with jack shit.
Robertson clapped three times to get everyone's attention.
Let's get started, he said.
Robertson's thick brown hair had recently started to go gray at the temples, a color that matched his glasses. He always looked half-rumpled, neither sloppy nor neat. His blue tie and bluer button-down shirt didn't quite hide a growing gut. That's what a desk job would do to you.
"Let's make it quick and get you back on the streets," he said. "I want to introduce Agent Tony Tryon, FBI."
The three-piece suit man smiled.
"Good morning. I'm here because I've spent the last 5 years watching Frank Lanza."
Ballpuller Boyd started laughing.
"Lanza? As in the Mafia Lanzas of the long-ago time?"
The FBI agent nodded. Chris Kearney crossed his arms over his sweater vest-covered chest and glared at the FBI agent. Brian wondered if Kearney doubted the man or was just jealous of the tailored suit.
"The mob hasn't been here since Jimmy the Hat died," Kearney said. "The Tongs and the Russians pushed them out."
Jennifer clacked her pen against the table. Tap, tap, tap.
"Wait a minute. Did you say the Hat? His mob nickname was the Hat? Not exactly frightening, is it?"
Tryon smiled at her. She smiled back. Brian noticed Pookie's scowl at the FBI agent.
"James Lanza frightened people just fine," Tryon said. "He ran the La Cosa Nostra in San Francisco for almost 40 years. His dad, Francesco, founded the whole thing back in Prohibition."
Tryon picked up a folder off the table and walked to a corkboard at the end of the room. He pulled out black and white copies and started pinning them to the board. Pictures of four men went up in a row, with a single face on top. The face in that photo showed a man in his early 40s, short black hair parted on the left side. Even in the still shot, Brian thought the man looked smug and condescending. Tryon tapped that top picture.
"Francesco Joseph Lanza, known as Frank, son of Jimmy the Hat, grandson of the first Francesco. For years we've known Frank has been asking for permission to take back San Francisco. Looks like he got it. We think he's been here for 6 months, maybe more."
"Bullshit," said Ballpuller Boyd. "We'd have heard he was in town."
Tryon shook his head.
"Like his father, Frank doesn't draw attention to himself. He's probably not here for the clam chowder, if you know what I'm saying."
The FBI agent smiled at the other cops, as if waiting for them to laugh at his joke. No one did. His smile faded. He shrugged.
"Anyway, Frank Lanza has been here for about 6 months. He brought a few guys out with him."
Tryon tapped the faces below Lanza as he called out the names.
"The big fellow with a shaved head is Tony Fourballs Gillum, Frank's right-hand man and bodyguard. The guy in the middle with the oft-broken nose is Polly Hatchet Caprice. This one is little Tommy Cosimo. Last but not least, and the real reason I'm here..."
He tapped the final picture.
"Is this sleepy-eyed gent, Pete the fucking Jew Goldblum."
Pookie raised his hand.
"The guy's nickname is the fucking Jew?"
"At least it's better than the Hat," Jennifer said.
"Goldblum is bad news," Tryon said. "No convictions, but he's got several hits to his name. If Lanza was behind Abramowitz's murder, you can bet Goldblum did the deed."
"But why Abramowitz?"
Pookie said.
"Taking out an accountant. Accountants don't mean shit. No offense, Chris."
"It's Christopher," Kearney said.
Pookie hit his forehead with the heel of his hand.
"Ah, damn, sorry about that."
Kearney looked at Pookie, then used his middle finger to rub his left eye. Pookie laughed.
"This accountant controlled cash flow for several organized crime outfits," Kearney said. "Abramowitz worked for the Odessa Mafia, the Watching Triad, and Johnny Yee of the Sui Sing Satong. More recently, Abramowitz was moving a lot of cash for Fernando Rodriguez, leader of the Norteños."
All those gangs were serious business. But Ryan's role in homicide brought him face to face with the Norteños more than any other outfit. For decades, the gang had spent most of their energy fighting their main rival, the Sureños. Under Fernando's guidance, however, the Norteños were expanding operations. Fernando was known for his smarts as well as his boldness. He would order a hit on anyone, anywhere, at any time.
"Abramowitz controlled money," Kearney said. "If you want to mess up cash flow in San Francisco, he was a good place to start."
Tryon again tapped on the picture of Frank Lanza.
Maybe Lanza offered Abramowitz a deal. Maybe Abramowitz didn't take the offer.
Robertson stood and smoothed his tie.
Thank you, Agent Tryon. That gives us more to look at. Tryon has copies of these photos for all of you, and he's been kind enough to share addresses and hangouts for Lanza's people. Brother Steve, go talk to Polly Caprice and little Tommy Cosimo. Klauser and Chang, track down Goldblum and see if he has anything to say.
Everyone started to file out, but Pookie hung back. Brian waited to see what his partner wanted.
Hey, Assistant Chief, Pookie said. Got a minute?
Robertson nodded, then shook Tryon's hand. Tryon walked out, leaving Robertson with Pookie and Brian.
What's up, Pooks? You have some thoughts on Lanza?
No,
Pookie said.
We've got thoughts on Paul Maloney.
Robertson nodded as he pushed his glasses higher on his nose.
Ah, I should have seen that coming.
Brian's throat felt scratchy and dry. He needed some water. Hopefully Pookie's whining wouldn't take long.
We want this one,
Pookie said.
Come on, man, it went down in the middle of the night. It's ours.
Robertson shook his head.
Not going to happen, gents. It's Verdi's case. Don't get me wrong,
Pookie said.
I like Rich Verdi. I also like my grandpa. My grandpa drools a lot and tends to shit himself. Not that I'm making any association with Rich's age, mind you.
Robertson laughed.
The fact that Chief Zhao wants you guys on the Abramowitz case is a compliment to your skills. Be happy with that. Now go talk to Goldblum. Find me something.
Robertson walked out. Pookie shook his head.
I hate this LITFA shit.
LITFA?
Leave it the fuck alone, Pookie said. The guys who should be on the case intentionally kept off it? An ME that hasn't left the office in half a decade assigned to work the body? Strange things are afoot at the Circle K, Bri-Bri.
Pookie had a point, but a couple of strange things didn't add up to a conspiracy. Sometimes the brass made decisions that didn't go your way.
Forget it,
Brian said.
Come on, the sooner we find Goldblum, maybe the sooner we get back on nights.
Chapter 5 Robin, Robin, Bobobin. Robin Hudson backed her Honda motorcycle into the thin parking strip on Harriet Street, just outside the San Francisco Medical Examiner's office. Several bikes were already there, some owned by her co-workers. The guys had 1200s. The women mostly had scooters. Robin's ride sat right in the middle, at 745 cc's. The morgue van was already backed into the unloading dock. Maybe it had been a busy night. She walked past the ambulances only sign and up the ramp toward the loading dock. She liked to enter work every day the same way her subjects did, through the doors where the bodies were rolled in. It surprised her to see her boss get out of the van and gingerly step down to the ground.
Dr. Metz, how are you this morning?
Metz stopped to look at her. He gave her his trademark single, slow nod.
Good morning, Robin.
Did you go out on a pickup?
When she'd started working here 7 years ago, Metz had gone out on pickups 3 or 4 times a week, whenever there was a really bad killing or something unusual about a body, something interesting. As the years had passed, she'd watched him go out less and less. These days, he rarely left the office at all. He still ran the department, though, expecting his people to display the same dedication and perfection that he had shown for almost 4 decades.
I did,
he said.
I'll do the x-rays myself right now, then I'll be in the private exam room for the next few hours. I don't want to be interrupted. Would you mind handling the department?
Sure, no problem.
Robin tried to keep her voice neutral, but she couldn't help but feel a little excited by the request, yet another sign that he was grooming her to replace him. She had a lot of work ahead of her, and a long way to go to qualify in his eyes, but everyone knew the chief medical examiner job was hers to lose.
Happy to do it, she said.
Thank you. And I will want to use that RAP scan machine. You received the training on it, yes?
She nodded. The rapid DNA tester was a potential sea change in law enforcement. DNA samples were usually taken at the morgue, then shipped off to labs for processing. Depending on the test, it could take weeks to get results, sometimes even as long as 2 months. The new portable machines, however, could be taken right to the body and provide a reliable DNA fingerprint in a matter of hours. Rapid Analysis, the RapScan 2000's manufacturer, had given San Francisco a model because of Dr. Metz's nationwide reputation in forensics. Metz had asked Robin to master the device. For all the RapScan 2000 could do, the size still amazed her. It was no bigger than a typical leather briefcase. Labeling and data entry were done on a built-in touchscreen. That same screen displayed results. Sample cartridges were the size of a matchbook, and the machine could process up to 4 samples simultaneously.
"It's easy," she said.
"You could have taken it with you into the field, you know. It's small enough to fit right in the back of the van."
"That's the point of it, Doc. If you'd started the process while you were in the field, it would probably be kicking out the results right now."
He thought about that, then gave his single, slow nod.
"That would have been helpful. Call the Rapid Analysis Company and tell them I want a second test unit, but do that after you show me how to operate it."
"Sure thing, Dr. Metz."
Why was he in such a hurry? She peeked past Metz to the body on the cart. The white body bag hid any details of the corpse, although the form inside it did look a little misshapen. She detected a whiff of urine. Not unusual for a body to void itself upon death, but it had to be pretty saturated for her to smell it through the thick material. She tilted her head toward the bagged corpse.
"Something interesting in there."
Metz looked at her for a few moments, as if he was thinking of saying something, but then decided against it. He spoke a fraction of a second before the stare would have become uncomfortable.
"Maybe," he said. "We shall see. A case like this, it's delicate. Maybe I'll tell you about it. Maybe soon."
"When you do, boss man, I'm all ears."
"Oh, I saw your boyfriend while I was out. How is Brian these days?"
Robin's smile faded.
"Brian and I broke up."
Metz's eyes saddened.
"Recently?"
"About 6 months ago."
He looked at her, then looked away. This time it was uncomfortable.
"Yes, you've told me about this before. Now I remember."
Not knowing what else to do, Robin just nodded. Metz rolled the body into the morgue one slow step at a time. Even at his age, he liked to handle everything himself. It was hard to watch him forget things. Had to be murder for him, a man whose life and identity rested squarely on his intelligence, to see the first signs of his memory slipping away. Robin walked through the receiving area where bodies were declothed, weighed, and photographed. She entered the offices, which consisted of a dozen gray cubicles that made the old yellow carpet look brighter by contrast. Printouts and paper clippings were tacked up to the cubicle's fabric, showing news coverage of various murders or high-profile suicides. Any photo that showed someone from the examiner's office in action immediately went up as a trophy. She put her helmet and jacket in her cubicle, then retied her long ponytail as she looked at the chalkboard. That was how the San Francisco ME office tracked incoming bodies and assignments. Not on computers, but on a 3-foot-wide, 6-foot-high green chalkboard. The board was divided into 3-by-3 sections that slid up or down, one under the other. The top board listed last night's work. 10 names scrawled in chalk, all reading the time of arrival, the examiner assigned to the body, and NC for natural causes. The board on the bottom was today's work, already 4 lines deep. 2 of those listed NC, while the other 2 listed a question mark. A question mark meant a probable homicide. She saw the line on the bottom with Metz's name in the assigned column. The stiff's name was Paul Maloney. Robin let out a long, slow whistle. Father Paul Maloney. That was high profile. Was that why Metz had gone on the pickup? That made sense. And yet, she'd felt like he'd wanted to tell her something else. Something he'd ultimately decided she wasn't ready for yet. What that might be, she didn't know. Whatever it was, it would have to wait. Because according to the board, Singleton John, N.C., and Quarry Michelle, question mark, were waiting for her. Chapter 6. Pookie's Sister. Pookie parked the Buick on Union Street, next to Washington Square Park, As he got out, his hands did their automatic forepat.